This is Bloomberg Best.
Bloomberg Best is about the insight and the context that we get from our guests.
It's a great way to catch up on some of the stories you might have missed on the Bloomberg.
Stories you're not going to find in any other news organization.
Bloomberg Best. Bloomberg's best stories of the day. Powered by 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries around the world.
From the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers Studio in New York, I'm Doug Krisner. On this edition of Bloomberg Best for Wednesday, November 27th, 2019, former Congressional Budget Director Douglas Holtz Eakin discusses the federal budget and today's U.S. GDP figures.
On the whole, this economy has been remarkable. It's had taken the headwinds of the trade wars pretty successfully.
And Greg Maloney, the CEO of JLL, discusses the 2019 holiday shopping season.
Even though there's 5 to 6 days shorter, we've really seen it start up a little bit earlier.
All this and more coming up in the next hour of Bloomberg Best.
We got a rush of economic data for the states today, beginning with a revision on third quarter GDP. The U.S. economy expanded at a 2.1% rate in the third quarter. That was better than the initial estimate of 1.9%. Meantime, demand for U.S. business equipment unexpectedly increased in October by the most this year. And for more on the economy, Bloomberg's David Westin spoke with Douglas Holtz Eakin, the former director of the CBO and current president of the American Action Forum.
I think on balance, this is a good day for economic data, but the GDP got revised in some important places, most notably business fixed investment got revised up a little bit. So did inventories. That's transitory. I wouldn't get carried away with that, but this has been an economy that's been carried by the consumer. What's been missing is some strength out of the business sector. We saw a really good sales number for new homes last month, and we saw existing home sales up. We've seen a record pace since 2007 for permits and starts. So that feeds into the notion that somehow we're going to get residential construction and business fixed investment sort of picking up some of the load of carrying the economy. That's the good news piece. And as you mentioned, the non-defense capital goods were up quite sharply, 1.2%. I think really if you took out the Boeing impact from the 737 MAX, this would all look really good. I mean, there would be no downside.
So tell us about the curve, because clearly the economy is slowing down somewhat. Certainly we're not up at the 3-4% level. We're slowing down. What does that curve look like? Is it leveling out as we go into the fourth quarter? Is it going to come down some more?
I think you could easily see it tick down some more and get a fourth quarter GDP number that looks like 1.7, 1.6. There's some tracking numbers that are below 1, but I think those are too pessimistic. So we are clearly slowing down. Some of that is going to be transitory. I think we'll see some of those inventories run off, and that'll depress the fourth quarter number a touch. But I think on the whole, this economy has been remarkable. It's had taken the headwinds of the trade wars pretty successfully. It's had a big drop-off in business fixed investment that comes from both confidence and also uncertainty about the supply chains. And we're still chugging along at roughly 2%. I think that's an accomplishment.
And how much of that is an accomplishment that just is because of the consumer as a practical matter? You mentioned earlier this issue. It's really sustained us. Can the consumer keep doing that? Does trade affect that consumer at all on their willingness to open up their pocketbook?
I think the consumer can continue to do this. I mean, let's look at the reality. The labor market's doing very, very well. Unemployment is extremely low. Wages are rising. Everyone would like faster real wage growth, and I'm in that camp, but we're still getting that wage growth. The household sector doesn't have a big problem on its balance sheet. So there's no real reason for the household sector to go south. They can keep chugging along. I don't think it gets affected too much by trade anymore. It's become sort of part of the chatter out there. You hear about it every day. And the dollar value of the tariffs, while real, isn't enough to stop it. So I think the household sector is in pretty good shape. We got to sort of look to the rest to pick it up a bit.
We're talking with Douglas Holtz Eakin. He's the former director of the Congressional Budget Office. So Douglas, let's talk about the politics of this for a moment, because we are entering into next year, an election year. And let's talk specifically about sort of swing states. The New York Times took a look at voters in six battleground states who voted for President Trump in the 2016 election, but actually voted for the Democrat the next time around. And what they conclude basically said, they'll stick with Trump as of right now. Even though they voted for a Democrat in the midterm, they'll go back to Trump. Given the nature of the economy, if you're looking at Wisconsin, you're looking at Michigan, you're looking at Pennsylvania, is this economy strong enough for people to stay with Donald Trump?
I'm going to give you two answers because, I'm an economist. I can't help it. But Here's the conventional wisdom. What matters is the economy and its performance 3 to 6 months out from the election. So right now isn't important. What's going on next June, say, is important. And if the economy is growing strongly enough and unemployment remains low enough and wage growth is there, then he's going to be in very good shape. Big advantage for an incumbent. In his case, I think it's a slightly higher bar because he said a lot about how Obama's economy wasn't satisfactory and an average growth rate of 2% wasn't any good. And so if you're growing at 2% in June, I don't think that looks so great from a political point of view. And so that's sort of how the economics of this election line up, at least at the moment. The one thing I will say is the caveat. The other story is go talk to the political strategists, the pollsters, the people who do those focus groups. And what they will tell you is the economy matters less than ever before, that this election has become extremely tribal, and there's only a couple swing voters out there who are going to determine the outcome.
What in the shorter term could actually affect the economy?
I think the downside risks are pretty obvious. They're primarily located in trade. Those are the ones that we can see. We could also see the global economy slowing further. There's a lot of weakness out there, and that hurts the U.S. As well. So that's the downside risk. The upside potential really is in residential construction, where, you know, the Fed easing has helped. Strong labor market helps. There's a very low inventory.
That was Douglas Holtz-Eakin, former director of the CBO and current president of the American Action Forum. Coming up, Mark Hamrick, senior economic analyst at Bankrate. This is Bloomberg. From the Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio in New York, this is Bloomberg Best. It's a big week for U.S. consumers as the annual retail extravaganza Black Friday is just around the corner. Bloomberg's Lisa Abramowitz and Paul Sweeney spoke with Mark Hamrick. He is the senior economic analyst at Bankrate. They discussed a Black Friday survey forecasting how much money Americans will be spending this holiday season.
Well, I'm sure it'll start off with a bang. Obviously, through this shopping period, which truly begins before November 1st. 40% of Americans indicated they would start their holiday shopping in that time frame.
Hold on a second. When is it just shopping? I mean, if you're starting it before November 1st, can we just call it shopping, or is it specifically for the holidays?
No, I think it's an intention to buy holiday gifts, and I think from a consumer standpoint, that's quite wise because we know that this industry is promotional almost all the time anymore because it's so competitive. And from a bank rate perspective, I also like the idea of not sort of taking the hit to either the bank account or the credit cards, late in the year if you have the ability to spread out those purchases. So to answer your question from a bank rate data perspective, we did ask Americans, by the way, and just published this survey this week, whether they intend to spend more, less, or about the same. And 52% of Americans said they intend to spend about the same as last year. Only 13% said they'd spend more, and 22% said they'd spend less.
So how does this cohere with the idea that this is the best time ever for consumers and that they're more confident than ever heading into Black Friday?
I guess the question best time for consumers, I'd want to play that out a little bit and have an idea about how that works exactly. But there's plenty of competition out there, and between online and brick and mortar, you certainly can pick and choose, and particularly in the apparel world where it feels like that is sort of yesterday's news in the sense of things to have. So, I think also consumers are always consuming, right? And so the question is, I think for a lot of people who are, you might call them well-qualified consumers, what do they need? And for many, the answer is not much, and I think that's one of the reasons why purchase of experiences has become more of a thing, because you can always have more experiences, but you don't necessarily need another sweater.
So, Mark, give us a sense of, from your survey work, are people going to spend money they have, or are they going to rack up some debt here going into the holiday season?
Yeah, and of course, that's one of our key concerns, right? And I think it should be our concern as a society or as a nation as well. And so I suppose the good news here is that a slight majority, 56%, said that they're going to spend money that they already have. And then of those who gave us an answer, in other words, if they had an idea about where they would use their financial resources. 37% said they'd use some combination of credit in that mix. Only about 6% indicated that they would use either most or all with credit. So only 6% are leaning heavily on the plastic.
You know, which raises a question in my mind. We've heard about the strength of the consumer powering the economic recovery in the United States over the past 5-10 years. I'm trying to understand how much this has been done on credit and how much further it has to go, given the fact that rates are still low, but that we are starting to see delinquencies tick up a bit, at least in credit cards and auto loans.
Well, rates are low from a credit card perspective, right? You know, we survey this all the time, and the average rate for a consumer credit card is 18%. Of course, you don't need to take that 18% hit if you're paying the balance off within the month, and then store cards are above 20. So, you know, I love the use of reward-oriented credit cards personally, but I loathe the idea of allowing those balances to go beyond 30 days. But to your question, I think it has as far to go as the economic expansion has far to go, and as long as we can have actual gains in income or wages, that is above the rate of inflation. And so, you know, I think that is sort of the conundrum, to use an Alan Greenspanish word, that, you know, while the Fed is sort of fighting to get inflation up to its would-be target, you know, a lot of consumers are sort of saying, hey, wait a minute, what about education? What about health care? Those should matter more, shouldn't they? Because those have the outsized impacts on our finances, and they do matter a lot, right?
So what are we hearing, or what are you seeing out there as it relates to Gen Z about how they're buying stuff out there? Are they still buying stuff, or are they just more into experiences?
Yeah, this is a great question, and I'm glad you asked it, because I think this may be one of the things that is going to be most fascinating in the period to come. And so for those who aren't all into the cohort categories here, we're talking about those who are age 18 to 22, and of course millennials are perhaps the most talked about to some degree take the most heat in print, et cetera, via use of the words latte and avocado toast, and I get a little tired of that, but the reality is that the Gen Z folks are really looking to be shaking things up with respect to, for example, looking to buy, you know, gently used clothing, for example. And when we ask people who is focused on saving as a reason why they're not spending more, Gen Z, again, those 18 to 22, popped up by far at the top of the list. That was 54%.
That was Mark Hamrick, senior economic analyst for Bankrate. Coming up, the EU's antitrust chief, Marguerite Vestager. This is Bloomberg.
This is a Bloomberg Quick Take. Context and background on issues of interest.
Our focus is on how green hydrogen could make green steel real, with Bloomberg's William Wilkes.
The situation.
Hydrogen is a fuel that can be burned to generate heat. Green hydrogen means hydrogen gas that was created by splitting hydrogen molecules from water using renewable energy sources like solar or wind.
The background.
Steelmakers think green hydrogen might offer a way to make emissions-free steel, which is important for an industry that the World Steel Association says creates almost 10% of all mankind's carbon dioxide emissions.
The argument.
Green hydrogen costs between $2.50 and $6.80 a kilogram to make. That's mainly because of the high cost of renewable-powered electrolysis. That would need to fall to below $2 in order to make it competitive with coal, and to around 60 cents to beat the cheapest natural gas-based production.
For more on green steel or other quick takes, go to Bloomberg.com, or for terminal customers, go to NI Quick. I'm Charlie Pellett, Bloomberg Radio.
Broadcasting live from the Interactive Broker Studio in New York, Bloomberg 1130. To Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 99.1. To Boston, Bloomberg 1061. To San Francisco, Bloomberg 960. To the country, Sirius XM Channel 119. And around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Best.
I'm Doug Krisner. The European Union will still be pursuing a digital tax, even if a global push at the OECD fails. This is according to the EU's antitrust chief, Marguerite Vestager. She told Bloomberg's Maria Tadeo that the EU needs to be more assertive on the tech sector.
first and foremost, of course, to promote what we have going for ourselves already, because in the business-to-business environment, you find a lot of impressive tech. You find engineers, you find research, and you find an impressive startup environment. And, of course, then the willingness to balance all the possibilities and to tame the dark sides.
And you're talking about innovation, but we do hear many times from U.S. companies that the reason why you're so focused on taxation is because we haven't really seen any real innovation in Europe. Do you agree with that? Is that fair?
No, that's absolutely not fair. What is fair is to say to all the many, many businesses who pay their taxes in Europe that not just some of them should contribute, but that every company should contribute where they do excellent business, because this is the bottom line in Europe. You do very good business here.
And when would that be? Is that something that you would still think if by the end of 2020 there is no international agreement on digital taxation, it'd be fair for the EU to just go at it alone?
Yes, of course it would. We are strong believers in a global agreement. I'm very happy to see the progress made by the OECD. There's a very strong push, and there's a positive feedback on their first drafts. So, of course, that would be the better solution. But if that cannot be met, well, when you look at all the businesses who pay their taxes, it would only be fair that we pick it up again if a global solution is not possible.
So based on what you hear now from the OECD, this time there is momentum to get this down, because we've been here many times and we haven't actually seen progress made.
I think normally I wouldn't be sort of optimistic when it comes to taxation, but I think now actually there is a momentum, there is a deeper understanding that we have to update sort of also corporate taxation to digital times. And in that respect, I think sort of the global dialogue is changing.
And we also heard today from President von der Leyen that data is key for this commission. Data is power, but it can also be weaponized. So what are you going to do about it? What measures to protect consumer data in Europe, and how are you going to deal with that?
Well, first and foremost, we're going to make a comprehensive strategy, because for AI, obviously, data is the main input. But data is so much more than a commodity. It's also what defines us as people in digital ages. We have taken a number of steps with sort of digital citizens' rights in the GDPR. We have a lot of public data that has been made available. But what we need is, of course, a comprehensive strategy for data to be the driving force, also of a prosperous European economy, and, of course, for the green transition.
And what timeline are you looking at?
Well, this has to be fast, because it ties in very well with what we are planning to do on artificial intelligence. And the two things will have to come together. But for people to see sort of the full scope of what data can do, well, then we have to make a specific strategy when it comes to data.
And mergers and acquisitions, that was a big theme for the old commission. I know you specifically said you disagreed with a few of them and you blocked the Amston Seamen. That led to criticism with the new commission. Are we going to see a change in the rules to perhaps make it easier to create big European champions?
Well, it is quite easy already. You know, we have giants that comes from mergers here, and the vast majority, they are just, you know, approved because we see no competition concerns. We don't question the business logic. It is so rare that this happens. And actually, the example that we have been discussing, well, they are not the prime examples. Actually, what we want to do more is to make sure that when it comes to data, that you cannot just acquire access to data that you would otherwise not be able to have if that causes a problem for competition.
And I have to ask you, as always, about American tech. We know there has been a number of probes, a number of big fines. Is there anything that you're looking at specifically now? Is there something they should fear from the new commission?
Well, everyone who plays by the book has absolutely nothing to fear. That goes without saying. But we have an investigation into Amazon's use of data in their dual role, both as host but also as competitor. And we're asking a number of questions to Apple and to Facebook right now.
That was the EU's antitrust chief, Marguerite Vestager. And coming up, Greg Maloney, CEO of JLL. This is Bloomberg.
With a Bloomberg Business of Sports report, I'm Michael Barr. The owner of the British soccer team Manchester City has agreed to sell a more than 10% stake to the U.S. private equity firm Silver Lake. The deal by City Football Group puts a valuation on the business of $4.8 billion, one of the highest ever for a sports team. The transaction shows how surging TV revenue is drawing attention from investors like Silver Lake, which has traditionally focused on tech companies such as Dell Technologies and China's Alibaba Group. SoulCycle CEO Melanie Whalen has resigned. CNBC reports both sides felt it was time for a change in leadership, citing a person familiar with the situation. Whalen also is resigning her director position. SoulCycle provides indoor cycling classes to music. It has more than 93 studios in the U.S., Canada, and the U.K. And that is a Bloomberg Business of Sports report. I'm Michael Barr.
From the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers Studio in New York, this is Bloomberg Best. It is 47 minutes past the hour, and it's time now for Bloomberg Opinion. David Westin spoke with columnist Joe Nocera about the NFL.
Bloomberg Opinion, informed perspectives, and expert data-driven commentary on breaking news.
From the Interactive Brokers Studio, it's time now for Bloomberg Opinion, and we welcome today columnist Joe Nocera. Joe Nocera always teaches me something, but he taught me something entirely new. I knew the Redskins were bad. The Washington Redskins football team is bad. I didn't know why, and I should have thought, it's a Washington team, follow the money.
Exactly. They're bad, but they're extremely profitable. Therefore, their owner, who's awful, Dan Snyder, has no incentive to make the team better. He wants to. He doesn't really know how to, but he makes so much money, there's no reason for him to.
And so that raises the question, how can you make that much money when you're that bad?
Right.
I think that you'd make more money if you were more successful.
Well, as the late Cleveland Browns owner Art Modell put it, the NFL is run by a bunch of fat cat Republicans who vote socialist on football. That's why.
And how do they do that? Give us the structure.
All right. So, first of all, the big thing is the television money. So the television money goes to the NFL Central, and it's just divided through all the teams. They get so much television money that the television money alone is $50 million or so bigger than the salary cap.
Wow.
The salary cap's $188 million, and what they bring in from television and other central NFL revenue is about $250 million.
Wow.
So that alone covers it.
So if they're paying out all the salary cap, they still are in the black from day one, just
Bingo.
On the TV memo.
Well, they have to pay coaches and other, you know.
But
it's basically a break-even proposition just from the TV money.
Does this differ from the NBA or the, or, you
oh,
know,
yeah.
or
well, it's
the other professional
different.
Sports franchises,
right. It's especially
MLB?
Different from Major League Baseball,
yeah.
Where there isn't that much national television. So most of the TV is local. And so the teams get all the money from the local. The other thing is, in the NBA and Major League Baseball, you get the entire gate. So every person sure. who comes in, that's money in your pocket. In the NFL, you only get 60% of the gate, and the other 40% goes to the visiting team.
Wow.
So it's another form of, shall we say, revenue sharing or socialism for billionaires.
So I thought that the original theory of this socialism, as Art Modell calls it, was parity. We're going to have better games. We're going to have teams that are more even, Steven, will have better games. But if you actually can encourage a team like the Washington Redskins or, heaven forfend, the New York Giants, to
right.
pick one, not to be so good, it doesn't help the games.
No, it doesn't help the games at all. I mean, when you look at this year, you have some really, really good teams like the 49ers and the New England Patriots. And you have a team, Cincinnati, they haven't won a game all season. They're 0-11.
But there's also no incentive for the owners to change this,
right? The Cincinnati Bengals make money. They don't make as much as the Redskins, but they make money.
See, that's fascinating to me, too, because I thought, without having paid attention, I never thought about buying a team, so it wasn't relevant to me,
right.
that basically you didn't make money year to year. You basically made it on the appreciation of the value of the underlying asset, because those assets have gotten
right.
really pricey.
That used to be true. That's become much less true over the years. Because, well, one reason is because the NFL has gotten deeply involved in extracting revenue from cities to build new stadiums. So they all have new stadiums that they're basically not paying for themselves, with the exception of the Patriots. They also have these stadiums that also have many more luxury suites than they used to, many more down front special seats that cost thousands and thousands of dollars. So the stadiums themselves, you know, besides being largely free, make them a lot more money than they used to.
So the way you lay this out, there's no incentive for Dan Snyder to go into the owners' meeting and vote to change the system. What about the guys that actually are successful, are putting out the good decisions, the good money, and they really are building dynasties? I mean, the Baltimore this year is doing great. The number
right.
one.
Well, they
team
made a owners. They made a great draft. They made a great draft pick. You know,
yeah.
I mean,
but they don't get as much of a reward. I get they get a reward, but it's not as
right.
much.
The reward is psychic. It's not financial. The reward is winning the Super Bowl or getting into the Super Bowl.
Thanks to Bloomberg Opinion columnist Joe Nocera. You can read more on this and other stories from Bloomberg Opinion at Bloomberg.com/opinion and on the terminal by typing OPIN Go. And now let's check in with the Bloomberg affiliates to find out what's happening on the nation's most influential radio stations.
I'm Ed Corey on WTAM in Cleveland. I'm reporting Faro is exploring strategic options, including a sale.
I'm Elisa Parenti on 1010 Winds in New York. I'm reporting on bankrupt Barney's deepening its clearance sale discounts on Black Friday.
I'm Tom Busby, and on WBZ in Boston, I'll be reporting on TJX, owner of chains like TJ Maxx, Home Goods, and Marshalls, under fire for selling recalled items.
I'm Courtney Donahoe on KFAB in Omaha. Heavy snow could prevent some farmers from harvesting the rest of their corn until 2020.
Thanks, Courtney. First comes the turkey, next the deals. Black Friday is nearly here, which means all eyes will be on consumers and retailers as the make-or-break holiday shopping season gets underway. Bloomberg's Scarlett Fu and Amanda Lang spoke with Greg Maloney, the CEO of JLL, a firm that leases commercial real estate to retailers.
Well, I think we're going to see a lot of the same that we've seen in the past. Even though there's 5 to 6 days shorter, we've really seen it start up a little bit earlier. Right after Halloween, we started to see retail sales start to pick up, and we started to see, obviously, the Christmas decor out in all the shopping centers. And people really started to shop early this year, given the fact that it's Thanksgiving is later this year.
And one of the interesting things, it seems as though there'll be a lot of omni-channel shopping and that the actual brick-and-mortar experience is alive and well. Is there an expectation that we will see a healthy in-store presence this year?
I think everybody's expecting it because the omni-channel approach with a lot of retailers have started to embrace is really giving the consumers a lot of choices. They can shop online and pick up in store, which has seen tremendous growth up to about 31% of all the online sales. So I think as you look forward to retail sales, brick and mortar is still the preferred. You're looking at about 94% of all sales still being done in a brick and mortar location, and only 3.9% of those sales are through pure play online retailers. So it'll continue to grow.
Yeah, but we have seen the pressure on brick and mortar, right, because of the growth of online. Is that rate of adoption changing at all?
Well, I think we've seen a lot of pressure on it because we have retailers out there that are not being able to provide the consumer what they want. So the consumer is driving decisions. They can go online and pick up and order things. So some of the obsolete retailers really need to pick up their game because our consumers, they want the experience, they want convenience, and they want value. And if retailers can deliver that, they're going to be successful in the years to come. Ones that can't are going to continue to die and fall off as they have in the past.
One of the things, of course, that has driven consumer spending in the absence of really material wage increases, Greg, has been a credit willingness to go into debt to make purchases. Do we have a lens on whether or not the American consumer is in that kind of mood? Because we've seen the savings rate in recent years tick up, which is actually bad for the economy.
Right. Well, we track a few key indicators. One of them is consumer confidence. Consumer confidence continues to remain very high. And when people feel good about themselves, their jobs, they have a tendency to, spend more, especially during the holiday season. And last year, we saw a big uptick in self-gifting. And I think in 2019, we're going to see a lot of self-gifting as well. As the research that we did is that over 50% of the people who shop are also going to self-gift. That's the sign of a good, strong economy where people feel good about things that are lying ahead.
So what are we seeing in terms of retail real estate? What are the fundamentals that are making a difference in this space?
Well, retail, the traditional mall, as we've seen it in the past, is really changing. People now want to live, work, and play in one location. So we're seeing more multifamily and food options and residentials added to the shopping experience. And when you look at some of the things that have been successful in the past, we're going to continue to see them grow in the future. We just opened up a property here in North Atlanta called Halcyon, and it's all about living, working, and having the ability to shop all in one location within a walking distance in a lot of cases.
So you are seeing properties being the home destination of investment. We're seeing some of your clients building into their brick and mortar investments.
Sure. If you look at some of the department store space that's that has been closed from a lot of bankruptcies on the anchors, we've seen all different kinds of uses, not just retail. We've seen hotels. We've seen office buildings. Co-working is very big. So a lot of the developers that have this space is looking for a lot of different opportunities to fill that space, and it's not all retail.
That was Greg Maloney, CEO of JLL. And that's all for this edition of Bloomberg Best. You can see all our best work at NI Best Go on the Bloomberg Terminal. Our show is produced by Caroline O'Brien. I'm Doug Krisner in New York. This is Bloomberg.